Pandora Papers implicated, among others, the Prime Minister of the Czech Republic for alleged tax avoidance. Now his supporters are going after the journalists who blew the whistle.
We receive a lot of hate emails and comments on social networks that we are trying to influence elections and that we are agents of foreign countries.
Also today, Senator Tammy Duckworth is calling for a nonpartisan 9/11 style commission to look at what went wrong in Afghanistan.
One of the things that we can do is to make sure we don't make the same mistakes ever again.
And India's transport minister hates honking car horns. He wants them to be replaced with something like this. But will it bring harmony to the streets? I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to be with you this Thursday. Some 5 days after the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists released the Pandora Papers, we may have the first political casualty of the revelations about how the rich shelter their wealth, the Prime Minister of the Czech Republic. The massive document leak released this week alleges that Andrej Babiš moved $22 million through offshore companies to buy several properties in the French Riviera. Babiš says he's done nothing wrong. Tomorrow, his credibility will be put to the test when voters decide who should serve as the next Czech prime minister. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
Andrej Babiš is a divisive figure in the Czech Republic. He's a billionaire businessman, reportedly the fourth richest man in the country. But he portrays himself as a man of the people, a populist who stands up against the elites. In a campaign video late last year, he put on a red baseball cap and quoted the former US president. Trump said, make America great again, Babiš tells the camera. I say, let's make the Czech Republic strong again. One of Babiš's big goals when he came to power in 2017 was to fight corruption. So it's not a good look that he now stands accused of moving millions of dollars through three separate shell companies to buy a lavish French chateau and other properties on the Mediterranean coast. The findings were revealed by the Czech Centre for Investigative Journalism as part of the Pandora Papers. Hanna Čapová, a reporter with the centre, tried to ask Babiš about the allegations last week. Have you ever had an offshore company in the Caribbean? Čapová asked the Prime Minister in this video. Babiš ignores her and keeps walking towards his car. He's surrounded by bodyguards. And then one of the security men turns on Čapová. The press conference is over. Don't you understand that, he says, and then tells her to go away. The centre's founder is Pavla Holcová. She tells me her reporters have gotten lots of abuse in the last few days.
We receive a lot of hate emails and comments on social networks that we are trying to influence elections and that we are agents of foreign countries. So we are getting it all.
I ask Holcová if she's worried that the threats could lead to something more serious.
It's kind of hard to really assess it, if it is real or just words. It's just making us tired, terribly tired.
Prime Minister Babiš has dismissed the allegations, saying it's all part of a smear campaign by the media. Luboš Paleta is the EU editor with the Czech newspaper Denik.
Andrej Babiš said this is part of an election campaign against me. And this is not true, but Andrej Babiš repeats this minimum 10 times any day.
Ann Paleta says it's working. Babiš's denials seem to have convinced his supporters that he's innocent. His political party still leads in the polls. Paleta points out that it's not the first time this Czech prime minister has been accused of corruption. Babiš is still facing charges connected to the misuse of EU funds, claims he also denies. On the campaign trail, though, the Prime Minister focuses on the issues he knows will fire up his base. More jobs, better pensions, and...
He talks about migration very often.
Jiří Pehe is the director of New York University's Academic Centre in Prague. He says there's one big problem with the Prime Minister's message.
The Czech Republic has not had any migration, and migrants avoid the Czech Republic if they can. So that seems to me as a sort of misguided strategy right now.
Pehe says it's hard to say whether Babiš will lose support in the elections this weekend. But even if the opposition parties win more votes, he could remain in the job of prime minister. That's because of a promise made by his close friend, the Czech president, Miloš Zeman.
even if the two opposition coalitions have between them a majority of seats, and if they say, we want to form a government, Mr. Zeman will still appoint Mr. Babiš to have the first shot, at least. And so it is really, in some ways, outrageous.
Still, even if Babiš remains in office, his troubles may not be over. Czech police plan to investigate the allegations laid out in the Pandora Papers. And French and US authorities may also start their own investigations. One of Babiš's companies is based in the US. If investigators from abroad come calling, being Czech Prime Minister won't grant Andrej Babiš immunity. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Today, the Nobel Prize in Literature was awarded to writer Abdulrazak Gurnah.
Shocked. You know, like when you receive a sudden jolt of something and your body's trembling a little bit.
That's how Gurnah described the moment he heard the news this morning, speaking there with the BBC. Gurnah is the author of 10 novels. The Nobel Committee praised his uncompromising and compassionate penetration of the effects of colonialism and the fate of the refugee in the gulf between cultures and continents. Gurnah spent much of his adult life in the UK, arriving as a refugee himself in the 1960s. He told the BBC that writing from a distance allows him to rely on his imagination.
These are things that are in my mind, where I grew up, where I was from. And in some ways, I don't think it's an unusual or peculiar thing for people who have moved, been displaced or whatever, displaced themselves, to be in their mind, as you were, always there, always in the place that they left, as well as in the place where they are.
We reached out to a colleague of Gurnah's, Bashir Abumane, who taught with him for many years at the University of Kent. I asked Abumane why he thought the Nobel Committee recognized Gurnah's work today.
They have discovered the magic that lies at the heart of Abdulrazak's project, this ability to combine the sense of individual autonomy and this pursuit of freedom, intersecting it with big history and objective processes. So this ability to tell individual stories out of the African continent, out of Zanzibar, a very small island in East Africa, and to try to connect those with much wider processes of immigration and exile and refugees and displacement and colonial violence and slavery in history. I think that ability is what caught the attention of the committee. There's also the way he styles his writing. It comes across in a very tender kind of way. It's a very modest form of writing. It doesn't do fanfare. It's very realist, very committed to pursuing the truth, very interested in the worldly substance of things, in giving due recognition to individuals, to communities and society at large. It's a very assured voice as well, very dignified, ethically committed, has absolute moral clarity, etc. And I think that also is what's distinctive about his work.
When you sit down with one of his books, what do you find that you can't find anywhere else?
I think Abdulrazak slows things down in his writing and allows you to penetrate not just an individual, but a whole world, a whole history, and takes you step by step and allows you to understand the perspective and the vantage point of the character that he's talking about and the difficult choices that they end up making in structures that they cannot control, that they haven't produced themselves. So it is that sense of ultimately helping you to understand someone else's condition. And he does that by slowing things down, being very, very careful about the details he provides and about the perspective he provides and about how he slowly builds up a narrative where ultimately you end up with a whole world either being destroyed and lost or being appreciated and savored, etc.
If you were going to recommend one of his novels to us, what would it be? And can you give us just a quick kind of synopsis?
I think Paradise would be the novel. This is a 1994 novel shortlisted for the Booker Prize in the UK. And it's a novel about a child who, as a result of his parents owing money and owing a debt, ultimately send him over to an uncle. Where he works for the uncle. He becomes in Arabic kind of a rahini. And it's his journey. So it's told from a perspective of a child in Africa in the early 20th century, at the cusp of transformation from an Africa which was much more autonomous, much more self-controlled, as it were, in its processes, to an Africa which was dominated by British and German imperialism. And so it tells that story brilliantly. And I think what it does is, very well, is this ability to try to present not just external forms of oppression and power that affect the continent, but also internal ones internal forms of unfreedom, the forms of individual oppression, which are key to his perspective and to his the way he conveys the sufferings and the pain of individuals on the continent and in Zanzibar. So I think that's a key novel.
He takes on a lot of history. These days, of course, yes, the world is grappling in such a visceral way with racism, the plight of so many refugees, and the long-term impact of colonialism. How does Gurna's work speak to this moment in time?
This notion of centering around individual dignity is absolutely key, that you have to learn the story, you have to learn the narrative, you have to understand the world from the perspective of the dispossessed, the marginal, the people who are ultimately suffering, crossing borders, trying to eke out a living, trying to live somewhere else without a homeland as a result of political pressure. I think that's the key story for the century and also for the 20th century. That, of course, links up to colonialism and the dispossessions of colonialism and the displacements of colonialism, but it also links up to exile, being far away from home, losing one's family, losing one's relations. And then the other positive dimension of his work is that the idea of adapting and trying to find a new home and trying to belong somewhere else because of these forced historical events. So there's a worldliness to his writing.
Bashir, what have you learned from Gurna's work about the deep wounds of colonialism, like how it's still very present and the way it impacts the psyche in ways that we in the West might overlook?
Being taken away from your history and inserted into a different history by force, that's conveyed, the violence of that. Not only the violence, also the permanent consequences of that. This idea that ultimately you can't go back to a pre-colonial time, that has been lost and destroyed. But there are also continuities between those two things. This notion that what we want in both pre-colonial times and also in colonialism and after is this notion of individual autonomy and individual freedom, that people seek to be able to shape their lives in ways which are allow for justice and allow for self-development. And those are the things that I've learned from him, and I worked very closely with him. So I had a very good chance of seeing how he talks about imperialism and colonialism to this new generation of students where it's very far from their experiences. They don't know about those kinds of processes, or they feel guilty about them because of parental heritage, etc.
Since you worked together at the University of Kent, can you share a favorite story with us about Gurna?
It's the first time I saw him teach. I was mesmerized by it, and I saw his effect on the students. His ability, very quiet, very dignified voice, his ability to convey complex history to the students, to talk about things which are very painful, which are very, very difficult to talk about. There are a lot of defenses, a lot of misunderstandings around that history. But capturing one story, one narrative, one trope, and then mixing that up with sometimes very complex theoretical propositions and concepts, that was absolutely magical. And you could see it on the students all the time. You know, there's a deep sense of what he represented to them, a model of a dignified, ethically committed individual who's trying to grapple with the pains and the sufferings of the world in an absolutely dignified way. I think that's what he did very well. Students, you know, they thought he was a magnificent teacher because he wanted to convey to them that ultimately what you have to do as a student is think for yourself. We have to give you the facts of history. We have to explain the historical processes about colonialism and imperialism and various other oppressions around the world. But ultimately, you have to make up your own mind. So he also respected them as intellectuals, and they felt that. So they wanted to have an ongoing conversation with him.
Bashir Abumanne heads the School of English at the University of Kent, which is where this year's Nobel Prize winner for literature, Abdulrazak Gurna, taught for many years. Bashir, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up, the UK has released a new report on the inclusion of transgender athletes in sports. The findings could have far-reaching effects, but not everyone agrees with the recommendations. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Transgender athletes in sports. It's become something of a lightning rod issue in the U.S. and elsewhere. In the U.K., new guidance from a nationwide council on sports equality says inclusion, fairness, and safety often cannot coexist. That's after an 18-month review of the matter. Those findings have been heavily criticized by LGBTQ advocates. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on how the new U.K. guidance could impact athletes there and across the globe.
The long-awaited report argues that trans women retain stamina and strength advantages over their cisgender female teammates. That leads to what they call a values-based dichotomy between inclusion and the integrity of sport itself. Hugh Torrance says that's a false conflict. He's the executive director of an LGBTQ organization called Leap Sports Scotland.
That's a bit of an impossible choice for sports organizations. You know, they're damned if they do, damned if they don't in that regard.
According to the new guidance, there are three potential paths forward. The first is prioritizing trans inclusion, which Torrance says has been the status quo up until now. Another idea is to design non-contact versions of sports so that everyone can play safely. And a third option is to create a new category of sport for non-cisgender women. Natalie Washington is a trans footballer who leads a campaign called Football v Transphobia. She says in many areas across the UK, this option wouldn't work on a logistics level.
In urban areas where you've got greater sort of numbers of trans and non-binary people, that might work to an extent. But if you're looking at most of the country where you've got lower population density, you struggle to get together enough people for one team. And then who could they play against? You know, they just aren't the numbers.
LGBTQ advocates are also pointing out the new report fails to mention or consult with authors of a major paper published earlier this year in the International Journal Sports Medicine. In that paper, 70 researchers agreed that no evidence currently exists to support banning trans athletes from sports. Here's lead author Blair Hamilton.
We were blindsided by this. Our work hasn't been referenced in it, and it's almost as if they've completely turned a blind eye to us.
For the UK report, of the 166 people interviewed, only 20 were, quote, transgender individuals or family members, according to the report's methodology. The sports councils declined my repeated interview requests for this story. In the report, they say they value inclusion and that sports must find innovative and creative ways to ensure nobody is left out. Their proposals are guidelines, and sports organizations are not obligated to follow them. But Hugh Torrance from Leap Sports Scotland says the councils have major influence because they directly fund many of the sport governing bodies.
I think and I worry that ultimately most bodies will end up feeling that they don't have a choice but to follow the guidance. And I'm also really concerned that many of those bodies who decide to perhaps not follow the guidance in the way that it's being presented may not be able to hold that position in the longer term.
Trans athletes I spoke with worry that even if the guidance isn't widely adopted, its existence could stop trans people from wanting to get involved in sports. Blair Hamilton says following the report's release, she went into a game with a newfound fear of transphobic abuse.
It's the first time I've ever went into a game thinking, am I going to get hurt or anything like that? It's quite a scary thought.
LGBTQ advocates are also concerned the UK proposals could set a precedent that influences global policy. Most leagues currently adhere to guidelines set by the International Olympic Committee, but their policies are now being revised. The IOC tells me that, quote, the discussions so far have confirmed the considerable tension between the notions of fairness and inclusion. Their new framework will be presented after the Beijing Olympics this winter. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Starting this week, millions of people outside of the U.S. will submit their names into a special lottery. They're not hoping to win money. It's the chance to apply for a U.S. green card. Each year, only a tiny fraction of entrants luck out. And even then, especially over the past 2 years, those winners have faced unprecedented challenges. The world's Daisy Contreras reports.
Neil Kutluk had a plan. The marketing professional thought she'd leave Turkey, her home country, and moved to the U.S. where she's wanted to work from for years. All she needed was an interview at the U.S. embassy for her visa.
Everything was going normally. And my expectation was that my number would be current around May. And then I would have an interview around June or July, the latest.
Kutluk is part of a small group from all over the world, randomly chosen for a chance to apply for a U.S. green card. It's called the Diversity Visa Program, or Green Card Lottery. And only 55,000 visas are given out each year. That is, until 2020.
And then everything stopped. We thought it was just for a month at the beginning, or a couple of months. We thought things would go back to normal.
But the Trump administration decided to stop processing the green card lottery visas because officials said that would keep immigrants from taking jobs in the U.S. during the pandemic. So that left thousands of diversity visa winners like Kutluk in limbo. In the end, she lost her chance at a green card. This year, the Biden administration restarted the program. But putting the visa applications through hasn't been a priority. The pandemic complicated things. Embassies were short-staffed and applications piled up. So even the next round of lottery winners missed their chance at getting visas too. Rafael Ureña, an immigration lawyer in New York City, says the diversity visa program hasn't always been treated this way.
I believe in over the last 2 years, it's not working as intended. It's not bringing in the full amount of people to really increase the diversity of the United States of America.
Similar systems have existed in the past, but the modern diversity visa program was signed into law by Republican President George H.W. Bush 30 years ago, with bipartisan support.
At that time, both parties believed that there was a richness that would be brought to the United States by a diverse population.
Today, most of the people who enter the visa lottery are from African countries and Eastern Europe, places where getting the U.S. visa can be very tough. Julia Jalot is with the Migration Policy Institute, a nonpartisan think tank in D.C. She says the Biden administration shouldn't leave diversity visa applicants hanging, but they're also not alone. There's a massive visa backlog overall. Millions of people are waiting.
The State Department could choose to prioritize the diversity visa, but that would come at the cost of other types of applicants, of family-based or employment-based applicants. And those trade-offs are really difficult.
Thousands of lottery winners have sued the U.S. government over the visa delays. The State Department didn't grant an interview, but in an email, a spokesperson said officials are trying their best to address the delays and stress that winning the green card lottery doesn't guarantee anyone a visa. It just gives them a chance to apply for one. Recently, a U.S. district judge ordered the State Department to set aside a small number of visas for people who miss their deadlines, like Neil Kutluk from Turkey. But she's still waiting to hear from U.S. officials.
This is really frustrating. We all keep our lives on hold. So I finally decided that I will do like there's no such thing and continue with my other options.
She just left Turkey and moved to England, her plan B. She'll stay there and start a consulting business. But just in case she's able to beat the odds again, Nutluk says she'll submit her name for the next green card lottery and keep waiting. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Transgender athletes in sports. It's become something of a lightning rod issue in the U.S. and elsewhere. In the U.K., new guidance from a nationwide council on sports equality says inclusion, fairness, and safety often cannot coexist. That's after an 18-month review of the matter. Those findings have been heavily criticized by LGBTQ advocates. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on how the new UK guidance could impact athletes there and across the globe.
The long-awaited report argues that trans women retain stamina and strength advantages over their cisgender female teammates. That leads to what they call a values-based dichotomy between inclusion and the integrity of sport itself. Hugh Torrance says that's a false conflict. He's the executive director of an LGBTQ organization called Leap Sports Scotland.
That's a bit of an impossible choice for sports organizations. You know, they're damned if they do, damned if they don't in that regard.
According to the new guidance, there are three potential paths forward. The first is prioritizing trans inclusion, which Torrance says has been the status quo up until now. Another idea is to design non-contact versions of sports so that everyone can play safely. And a third option is to create a new category of sport for non-cisgender women. Natalie Washington is a trans footballer who leads a campaign called Football v Transphobia. She says in many areas across the UK, this option wouldn't work on a logistics level.
In urban areas where you've got greater sort of numbers of trans and non-binary people, that might work to an extent. But if you're looking at most of the country where you've got lower population density, you struggle to get together enough people for one team. And then who could they play against? You know, they just aren't the numbers.
LGBTQ advocates are also pointing out the new report fails to mention or consult with authors of a major paper published earlier this year in the international journal Sports Medicine. In that paper, 70 researchers agreed that no evidence currently exists to support banning trans athletes from sports. Here's lead author Blair Hamilton.
We were blindsided by this. Our work hasn't been referenced in it. It's almost as if they've completely turned a blind eye to us.
For the UK report, Of the 166 people interviewed, only 20 were, quote, transgender individuals or family members, according to the report's methodology. The sports councils declined my repeated interview requests for this story. In the report, they say they value inclusion and that sports must find innovative and creative ways to ensure nobody is left out. Their proposals are guidelines, and sports organizations are not obligated to follow them. But Hugh Torrance from Leap Sports Scotland says the councils have major influence because they directly fund many of the sport governing bodies.
I think and I worry that ultimately most bodies will end up feeling that they don't have a choice but to follow the guidance. And I'm also really concerned that many of those bodies who decide to perhaps not follow the guidance in the way that it's being presented may not be able to hold that position in the longer term.
Trans athletes I spoke with worry that even if the guidance isn't widely adopted, its existence could stop trans people from wanting to get involved in sports. Blair Hamilton says following the report's release, she went into a game with a newfound fear of transphobic abuse.
It's the first time I've ever went into a game thinking, am I going to get hurt or anything like that? It's quite a scary thought.
LGBTQ advocates are also concerned the UK proposals could set a precedent that influences global policy. Most leagues currently adhere to guidelines set by the International Olympic Committee, but their policies are now being revised. The IOC tells me that, quote, the discussions so far have confirmed the considerable tension between the notions of fairness and inclusion. Their new framework will be presented after the Beijing Olympics this winter. For the world, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Starting this week, millions of people outside of the U.S. will submit their names into a special lottery. They're not hoping to win money. It's the chance to apply for a U.S. green card. Each year, only a tiny fraction of entrants luck out. And even then, especially over the past 2 years, those winners have faced unprecedented challenges. The world's Daisy Contreras reports.
Neil Kutluk had a plan. The marketing professional thought she'd leave Turkey, her home country, and move to the U.S. where she's wanted to work from for years. All she needed was an interview at the U.S. embassy for her visa.
Everything was going normally. And my expectation was that my number would be current around May, and then I would have an interview around June or July, the latest.
Kutluk is part of a small group from all over the world, randomly chosen for a chance to apply for a U.S. green card. It's called the Diversity Visa Program, or Green Card Lottery, and only 55,000 visas are given out each year. That is, until 2020.
And then everything stopped. We thought it was just for a month at the beginning. Or a couple of months. We thought things would go back to normal.
But the Trump administration decided to stop processing the green card lottery visas because officials said that would keep immigrants from taking jobs in the U.S. during the pandemic. So that left thousands of diversity visa winners like Kutluk in limbo. In the end, she lost her chance at a green card. This year, the Biden administration restarted the program. But putting the visa applications through hasn't been a priority. The pandemic complicated things. Embassies were short-staffed and applications piled up. So even the next round of lottery winners missed their chance at getting visas too. Rafael Ureña, an immigration lawyer in New York City, says the diversity visa program hasn't always been treated this way.
I believe in over the last 2 years, it's not working as intended. It's not bringing in the full amount of people to really increase the diversity of the United States of America.
Similar systems have existed in the past, but the modern diversity visa program was signed into law by Republican President George H.W. Bush 30 years ago, with bipartisan support.
At that time, both parties believed that there was a richness that would be brought to the United States by a diverse population.
Today, most of the people who enter the visa lottery are from African countries and Eastern Europe, places where getting the U.S. visa can be very tough. Julia Jalot is with the Migration Policy Institute, a nonpartisan think tank in D.C. She says the Biden administration shouldn't leave diversity visa applicants hanging. But they're also not alone. There's a massive visa backlog overall. Millions of people are waiting.
The State Department could choose to prioritize the diversity visa, but that would come at the cost of other types of applicants, of family-based or employment-based applicants. And those trade-offs are really difficult.
Thousands of lottery winners have sued the U.S. government over the visa delays. The State Department didn't grant an interview, but in an email, a spokesperson said officials are trying their best to address the delays and stressed that winning the green card lottery doesn't guarantee anyone a visa. It just gives them a chance to apply for one. Recently, a U.S. district judge ordered the State Department to set aside a small number of visas for people who miss their deadlines, like Nil Kutluk from Turkey. But she's still waiting to hear from U.S. officials.
This is really frustrating. We all keep our lives on hold. So I finally decided that I will do like there's no such thing and continue with my other options.
She just left Turkey and moved to England, her plan B. She'll stay there and start a consulting business. But just in case she's able to beat the odds again, Nutluk says she'll submit her name for the next green card lottery and keep waiting. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
You're listening to The World. Migrants enter a country and have the right to ask for asylum. At the border of Croatia, a journalist saw clandestine security teams push migrants back into a river.
Then I saw four guys in dark uniforms with their faces covered, and they were beating the people into the water.
Journalists expose violent force at the doors to Europe. Still ahead, here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. 20 years ago today, less than a month after 9/11, then-President George W. Bush addressed the nation.
Good afternoon. On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
Of course, this year in August, Afghanistan fell to the Taliban again, and President Joe Biden addressed the nation.
Our mission in Afghanistan has taken many missteps, made many missteps over the past two decades. I'm now the fourth American president to preside over war in Afghanistan, two Democrats and two Republicans. I will not pass this responsibility on to a fifth president.
President Biden announcing there that the U.S. war in Afghanistan was over. Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth from Illinois, herself a veteran, has called for a commission to study the past 20 years of U.S. involvement in Afghanistan. Senator Duckworth joins us from Washington. You've called your proposal, Senator, the Afghanistan War Study Commission. What do you hope it will achieve?
Well, I hope that it will achieve a comprehensive look at the various errors that have been made by all the different folks involved and gives us the lessons learned so that we don't get ourselves into a situation where we spent 20 years at war in a country only to come away and have the people who were in charge when we got there come back in charge when we leave.
There have already been a series of lessons learned reports on the Afghanistan war. How will your committee and investigation be different?
Well, the key thing is that I want it to be completely nonpartisan, not bipartisan, but nonpartisan. I've served on bipartisan commissions before. I served on the Benghazi Commission, for example. That was bipartisan, but it was highly political. I want this to be a real cold, hard facts look. I don't want anybody on the commission that was in any position of decision-making or authority during those 20 years. So not a past Secretary of Defense who was in charge at the time, not a previous president, not a member of Congress. This needs to be someone who can lead this commission, much like the 9/11 Commission, and bring us the lessons learned. Whether it is the legislative branch failing to reauthorize a new authorization for use of military force or presidents choosing to do a troop surge or the corruption trying to do nation building with the military as opposed to nation building with the State Department. All of the things that led us to where we are today, we really need to do is make sure that we do this in a systematic way. I think the 9/11 Commission is a great example of the kind of work that can be done. And it must produce actionable recommendations.
Like what? What would you see as an actionable recommendation?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at contracting, a significant portion of what happened is corruption within the Afghanistan government, within their national security forces. We know about the ghost soldiers in that we paid for the salaries of many, many thousands of so-called Afghan national security forces who never existed. And in fact, were on the books only, and their commanders collected that money. That corruption piece is really important. We certainly need to do an actionable recommendation for Congress would be any type of authorization for use of military force must sunset after 3 years or must sunset after 5 years. You must have a new look and a new debate instead of keeping an old one that lasts 20 years. So there are things that can be done.
You were on the committee that investigated the disaster at the U.S. Embassy in Benghazi, Libya in 2012. That turned out to be a deeply politicized committee. What did you learn from that?
Not to make it bipartisan. Make it nonpartisan. Don't let the politicians get involved. And if you watch the Benghazi commission and watch my questioning, you'll see that I tried really hard to keep my questions and my focus solely on what are the lessons learned so that we never have an ambassador get killed in that way, so that we never have an embassy that's not listening to the intelligence community or is overriding what military leaders are saying, hey, we should be doing this. It was my experience in the Benghazi committee that led me to say, hey, what this needs is complete independence. It needs to be cold, hard, independent look with real actionable recommendations coming out of it. That's how we can best serve the American people with this commission.
Senator, when do you think the committee would present its findings? And are you worried that if it takes a few years, a report on what went wrong from 2001 to 2021 might not be must-read material anymore?
Well, I think it will be must-read materials. I mean, I'm still looking at lessons learned from the Civil War. When I was an ROTC cadet, they took us to Gettysburg and we reenacted all of the battles to talk about the lessons learned from Gettysburg. I think lessons learned here will be relevant for many, many more decades into our nation's future. In addition to the long-term results, I think there will be many short-term findings that we can find out right away. For example, one of the things that we're hearing is that I've known this, but it's the State Department that calls for the evacuation of civilians on the ground, what's called the NEO operation, the non-combatant evacuation operations. The decision to start that is not the DOD, it's actually the State Department. So there are some things that are more short-term lessons learned that we can get the results of in the next months or the first 6 months or first 12 months of this commission. But I think we're going to see findings and results coming out all along the way, even as the commission continues to do its work.
Finally, you've been a senator since 2017. Prior to that, we must remember you were deployed to Iraq. That was 2004. And then later that year, your Black Hawk helicopter came under attack from an insurgent rocket, a horrific attack that left you a double amputee. How much did your own experience energize a desire to not leave any stones unturned from the last 20 years of war in Afghanistan?
My personal experience is the core of who I am. I should have died in that day in Iraq, and my buddies didn't give up on me. And those same buddies later on returned and did more deployments. And that was really at the heart of why I want this commission, because our troops, over the last 20 years, many of them have had 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, I've heard of 10, 12 deployments. And every time we ask our troops to go overseas and they stand up and they salute and they pack their rucksacks and they go. And I feel like we, who are here at home just haven't lived up to the dedication and the sacrifices that these troops made. And one of the things that we can do is to make sure we don't make the same mistakes ever again. And so, yeah, it does. My experience as a soldier does drive me now because I feel that I owe my life to the men who saved me. And that means that now that I am in this position as a United States Senator, that I'm not going to shirk that duty. You know, my buddies have sons and daughters who are serving, and maybe someday one of my two girls will serve. And I want to make sure that we do right by them. And one of the things we can do is to have a cold, hard look when we make mistakes, learn those lessons, and let's not make them again.
Senator Tammy Duckworth of Illinois, thank you very much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure to be on. Thank you.
Slowly but surely, in-person concerts are happening again. Music aside, one of the world's biggest in-person events is taking place right now. Expo 2020 is being hosted by the city of Dubai and the United Arab Emirates. It was supposed to have happened last year, but got delayed because of the pandemic. As the world's Shirin Jafari reports, Expo 2020, for a number of reasons, has been mired in controversy.
Let's start with what a World Expo is. Since 1851, every 5 years, countries from around the globe come together in one place to show off their latest innovations.
America's World of Tomorrow is ready for its formal debut, the mighty exhibition which is a monument to imagination, showmanship, and industry.
In 1939, the Expo in New York City featured the first live TV broadcast. In 1876, Alexander Graham Bell demonstrated the first telephone in Philadelphia, and the X-ray machine was unveiled at the Expo in St. Louis in 1904. This year, at the Dubai Expo, the city is boasting the world's largest unsupported dome, called the Al Wasl Plaza. Expo 2020 is the first to be held in the Middle East. The UAE won the bid to host in 2013. It took 8 years and cost about $7 billion to build. What was there at the site before?
There was nothing, okay? It was just like plain piece of sand with a lot of dunes and just a couple of trees and a camel farm.
Ahmad Al-Khatib, Chief Development Officer for the Dubai Expo, speaking to CNN there. The sand dunes and the camel farms have been replaced with huge, glitzy structures. Each of the 192 countries participating has their own pavilion or station. Robert Mogolniki is with the Arab Gulf States Institute.
The pavilions are a limited space and a theater for these countries to highlight and to emphasize just one or two key messages that they would like to communicate to a global audience.
China, for example, is focusing on space exploration and next-generation technology. Iran is showing off its hand-woven carpets, and Yemen is showcasing its honey and coffee. Mogolniki says the UAE is hosting this expo with the hope of reaping financial benefits.
Early forecasts suggested that the UAE would derive an economic benefit of about $6 billion in terms of a boost to its GDP during the expo itself. And then the hope was that there would be another $17 billion that would trickle in over the next decade as a result of the expo.
They expected 25 million visitors, but Mogolniki says that might not be realistic given the ongoing travel restrictions and concerns about COVID. Visitors are required to show a negative test and wear masks. The Dubai Expo does come with its share of controversy, though. In September, the European Parliament voted to boycott the event, citing the UAE's human rights record. It pointed to workers' rights, the government's use of spyware to target journalists and activists. Expo authorities admitted this week that 6 workers died during the construction of the venues, some in accidents, others after contracting COVID-19.
You know, the standards are quite decent. The tricky thing is that, you know, there's very little transparency.
The person speaking here works with an organization in the Persian Gulf called Migrant Rights. It tracks and exposes migrant workers' abuses. She didn't want me to use her name because that could prevent her from working in the region. She says Gulf countries like the UAE often hire workers through contractors, and these workers come from places like India, Pakistan, and Nepal.
The most common issues that they face tend to be of non-payment of wages. And during the COVID-19 pandemic, this was, you know, greatly exacerbated because a lot of the, you know, construction work stopped.
She says often workers don't speak Arabic or English, which means they have difficulty advocating for themselves. Adam Kugel of Human Rights Watch says the UAE cracks down on any type of criticism.
The UAE likes to portray itself as an open and tolerant country, and it spends billions and billions of dollars, you know, hosting events or engaging in public relations campaigns to put out that image. But the truth couldn't be further from that image.
The international community, Kugel says, could pressure the UAE government by not participating in events like Expo 2020. In the U.S., Congress has banned the use of public funds to finance expos. But the UAE stepped in and said it will pay the $60 million cost on behalf of the Americans. Now the U.S. Commissioner General to the Expo, Robert Clark, says he's going to lobby Congress to pitch in as well. Here he's speaking with CNBC International.
You know, what we're trying to do is attract the millions of people that are going to be coming here to get excited about our programs and come to the United States, go to college in the United States, come and visit the United States.
The U.S. pavilion reportedly features a replica SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket and a copy of the Quran that belonged to President Thomas Jefferson. The Dubai Expo will go on until March. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Canada needs more immigration to keep growing. That is the official word from Ottawa. But the pandemic and all those border restrictions have been getting in the way. Last year, immigration to Canada fell by half. So now the Canadian government is allowing temporary residents to apply for permanent residency, people who normally would not qualify. Reporter Anita Elash has more from Toronto.
Arjan Van Dam and his family first came to Canada from Holland 6 years ago on an extended tourist visa.
We just came for 6 months. We looked into it and we said, you know what, it's an amazing country.
Van Dam got a job managing the Canadian division of a Dutch company that supplies equipment to greenhouses in the Niagara fruit and wine growing region. The plan was to stay here permanently, but pretty soon he discovered it wasn't that simple.
I didn't have enough points.
Immigration applications are processed on the basis of points. He had some points in his favor to get permanent resident status. He had a great job and 3 of his 5 children were born in Canada. Points against him, he never finished high school.
Some people, they learn easy at school. Other people, they don't. I'm just super practical. When I usually see things, I can do it. And that got me all the way into Canada. But there is no value for that.
The new program is open to 90,000 people like Van Dam, who didn't qualify under previous rules. It includes international students and temporary workers with little education who are already in Canada doing unskilled jobs such as cashiers and janitors. Immigration Minister Marco Mendicino said on Canadian public television that allowing them to stay will accelerate Canada's post-pandemic economic recovery.
We're embracing an argument that economists have long made, which is that, yes, of course, we want an immigration system that welcomes highly educated, highly experienced newcomers. But there are also a number of other newcomers who possess a range of skills that are required.
Before the pandemic, Canada's population was growing faster than any other G7 country. Nearly all of that growth came from immigration. Andrew Agopsawiz is a senior economist with the Royal Bank of Canada. He says the country needs those immigrants to make up for the fact that Canadians are getting old fast.
Lots of people are retiring, especially people with lots of experience and skills. It's difficult to replace those people.
If immigration levels remain low, Agopsawiz says Canada would have trouble paying for its social programs.
In order to maintain the level of service that we promise elderly going into the next 10 years, we need to have strong labor force growth. And I think immigration is really the only way to maintain it.
The Canadian government says the new program recognizes the contribution of immigrants who worked essential unskilled jobs during the pandemic. Immigration experts say it also represents a huge one-time opportunity for tens of thousands of foreign students who came to Canada hoping their Canadian degree would earn them permanent status. Students like Faustina Boadu.
Oh, it's going to make a huge difference, a big difference in my life.
Canada welcomes hundreds of thousands of international students every year, 641,000 in 2019. But only about one quarter find work in their field and earn the right to stay permanently. Others go home or stay on temporary work permits. One internal government report found that even in pre-pandemic times, most foreign students were stuck in unskilled jobs and earned half as much as Canadian college grads.
Honestly, I don't even wish this for my enemy. It's tough. It is hard. Like, I am losing my mind.
Boadu was a nurse back home in Ghana. She moved to Canada in 2015 to earn a degree as a dental hygienist. She expected that would earn her the right to stay for good, but it didn't.
Nobody explains anything. And for me, coming to like a new country, I didn't know anybody. I didn't know like nothing. So I did everything on my own. I just applied for the course, not knowing that there was going to be this challenge.
Boadu managed to get a temporary work permit that allows her to stay in the country, but it ties her to a low-wage job as a personal support worker in a nursing home. She has a 2-year-old son who was born in Canada. She says she barely earns enough to pay a babysitter when she has to go to work.
It's affecting my job. It's affecting me mentally. It's affecting my son. Because if my mental health is not in a good state, I feel like it's going to affect my child.
Boadu said that if she gets her permanent resident card now, she'll be free to go back to school to qualify for better-paying, more skilled work. Her husband, who runs a business in Ghana, will also be allowed to join her. For The World, I'm Anita Elash in Toronto.
Journalists have uncovered damning new evidence against some European countries that are turning migrants and asylum seekers away from their borders in increasingly violent and clandestine ways. An investigation by Lighthouse Reports, a consortium of European journalists, found masked security personnel operating in three European Union member states. Their goal? To repel migrants from entering the European Union. Journalist Klaas van Dijken is director of Lighthouse Reports and witnessed this firsthand. He joins us now from the Netherlands. Last month on our own show, Klaas, we reported on a Syrian family that had made their way to Greece. They claimed they were then violently pushed back across the border into Turkey. Is that what's happening in Croatia?
Yes, it's kind of the same. A lot of people who have been in Greece before, they end up in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and they try to enter the EU via Croatia.
And these migrants originate from where?
A lot of them are from Afghanistan, and then there are big groups of Pakistani, but also people from Syria and Sudan.
So as you were doing this reporting, where were you?
I was on the Bosnian side of the border, but very close to the Croatian side, less than 30 meters away.
So Croatia, we should mention, it's part of the European Union and Bosnia-Herzegovina is not, which is why the migrants were trying to get to Croatia, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So if they would take the normal way and they would claim asylum at the border, Croatia would just simply send them away. So what they're trying to do is to cross into the European Union by going through the forest and over the mountains. But once they enter Croatia and they run into police, they try to claim asylum. But then instead of the asylum process, the Croatian forces just put them into vans and drive them back to the border where they beat them. They take all their belongings, phones, money, backpacks, even shoes, and then send them back or force them back over the border.
Just to underscore, migrants, once they cross into a country, they have a legal right to apply for asylum, right?
Yeah, it's a basic right of everybody. So wherever you are, you are allowed to seek asylum.
So you witnessed this happening at the border of Croatia and Bosnia-Herzegovina. Set the scene for us. What did you see?
It started with the noise, actually. I heard the beatings and the screamings of people that are really beaten severely. And then what I saw was people coming out of the forests and they were forced to jump in a river. Then I saw four guys in dark uniforms with their faces covered with balaclavas and they were holding a baton and they were beating the people into the water.
And then those people are forced back into Bosnia-Herzegovina?
Correct.
Were you at all able to speak with the migrants themselves before they were repelled?
Yes, we were able to speak to the people that you can see in the video. They waited until the Croatians left the place. Then they showed us also the wounds that they had on their backs, on their legs. Some, they had broken arms.
So you said, Klaas, the officials beating the migrants and sending them back to Bosnia-Herzegovina were Croatian officers. What do we know about the masked men who were pushing the migrants back?
Well, it took us a little while to identify who these men were. That is because they wear masks, so balaclavas, to cover their faces, but they also have uniforms without insignia. They were wearing quilted jackets, and it was hot that day. So after seeing that footage, I thought, okay, maybe this is some kind of underjacket. And we went to a police source who has all the official Croatian police uniforms in his house. And we took a photograph of the underjacket of the so-called intervention police, which is some kind of riot police in Croatia. And it was 100% match. We also spoke to police officers who were active or are still active in these kind of border operations, and they call it Operation Corridor. And this is operation to stop border crossings by asylum seekers. And they were all saying that this is part of that operation.
Mm. So according to your report, the Croatian Operation Corridor gets funding from the EU. Would the EU have known that that's how those resources are being used? And what will be the consequences of that for Croatia?
I don't know if the European Union knew that the money was used for this. What I do think is that they knew what was going on, or at least they should have known the reports that are out there for years already by journalists, activists, NGOs. They all reported about this, but there wasn't any visual evidence. By now, they cannot longer say that well, we don't know for sure that this is happening. No, the violence is happening, and here's the proof.
Have EU authorities seen your videotape and the report?
Yes, they have. They confirmed that they are financing border operations. They also said that they didn't know about this. And the European Commission said that they will investigate this. They are very worried about the violence. And they will meet with the ministers of interior of Croatia and Greece.
Journalist Klaus van Dijken is director of Lighthouse Reports, a journalism consortium which has been reporting on and witnessing forced pushbacks of migrants in three EU countries. Klaus, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Traffic in India's big cities is among the most chaotic in the world. Overloaded trucks and packed buses jostle for position with cars, scooters, and rickshaws. It seems as if drivers in India lean on their horns as much as they press on the gas. It's not so much the sign of an impatient driver. Honking is more a form of communication. I'm on your bumper. I'm about to pass. Get out of my way. India's Minister for Road Transport and Highways says that all that honking is crazy-making. He wouldn't be the first, but his solution is one we have not heard before. At a highway opening ceremony this week, Minister Nitin Gudkari told the crowd, "I am studying this and soon plan to make a law that the horns of all vehicles be replaced by Indian musical instruments so that it is pleasant to hear." Among the traditional Indian instruments Gudkari said could replace car horns is the Indian flute, also the Indian drum or tabla, and the harmonium. Gudkari says under his new law, he will also end the use of sirens on ambulances and police cars. In fact, he says there is a tune played early in the morning on All India Radio that he finds soothing and would work nicely for EMS. The transport minister says he's thinking of using that tune for ambulances so that people feel pleasant. Not sure how the patients inside the ambulances will feel about that or what this plan might mean for road safety. Personally, I love this idea. Through some artful sound editing, we mixed all of the minister's favorite musical instruments together, and we can imagine what the busy streets of India might sound like if the law passes. Yep, that is one traffic jam I can actually enjoy. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Stay safe, be patient, and we'll see you again tomorrow for another spin of the world. ¶¶